it's time for Teach Me What You Know. This week, smack dab in the middle of vacation season, we'll learn how to overcome a fear of flying.
This summer, there have already been some high-profile airline disasters causing even more anxiety for people who are already nervous about flying. So we've brought in a former airline pilot turned therapist to help deal with the fear of flying. He is Captain Tom Bunn, president of SOAR, a company that helps clients overcome their fear of flying, and the author of SOAR, The Breakthrough Treatment for Fear of Flying. Tom Bunn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So it's 2014. Tell me how common this idea of fear of flight is these days.
Well, about one person in three has trouble with it. And of that one in three, half don't fly and half white knuckle it. If you look at the record we've had in the last 10 years in the U.S., no major U.S. airline has had a fatal accident. But the statistics don't seem to change how people feel about it, because in order to feel safe, we need to be in control, or we need to be able to escape a situation that goes bad immediately. And that isn't possible on an airplane.
And the fear of flying, it's not necessarily a rational calculation of the risks or anything like that. What is behind the fear people feel when they're flying? Is it that lack of control you mentioned?
Well, yes, because there is an interesting mechanism in the brain that, first of all, there's a thing we call the amygdala. It sounds like a funny word, but it's just a Greek word meaning almond. There's an almond-shaped and almond-sized little cluster of brain cells that is highly interconnected, sits right behind the eye. And its job is to act sort of like a smoke alarm in your house. It sits there and monitors what's going on all the time. And as long as everything is routine, you don't hear from it. Been there, done that, that's boring. So it kind of memorizes what you do day in and day out, and that lets it ignore anything that's routine. But if something happens that's not routine, or even you imagine it vividly, the amygdala is going to fire off stress hormones. Okay, when it does, it grabs your attention, just like the smoke alarm does with noise. So if it grabs your attention, then what do you do? First, you want to take a look and see what's going on. If you can be sure that what's going on is a false alarm, there's no problem, you drop it, and that's the end of the stress hormones. But if you're not sure, then the next step you go to is, all right, what do I need to do about this situation? And the way the brain is wired up is if you can come up with something to do, and the thing I think is amusing is it doesn't matter whether the plan you come up with is a good one or a lousy one, whether you commit to it, that's the key thing. If you commit to a lousy plan or a good plan, it's going to stop the release of stress hormones, at least until you find out it's a lousy plan. Then it might start all over again. But when you drive your car and a car comes at you, you get a shot of stress hormones, you decide what to do. You hit the brake, turn the wheel, whatever, and that stops the stress hormones, so people feel very comfortable in their cars. And then the second thing is, if you can't come up with a plan, then you want to be able to get out of there. And in the airplane, you can't. So here's where you're stuck. First of all, when you hear a noise or feel the motion in the plane, you're going to get the stress hormones. You can't be sure that you're absolutely safe. So you go to the control. Ah, wait a minute. I don't control this situation. I need to get out of here. Oh, I can't do that either. So you can see it's not a good recipe for emotional control if you have to control emotions consciously. Now, there are people who, because they feel so secure in general, they regulate stress hormone release unconsciously. They don't understand why anybody has a problem with flying. But a person who has to regulate it consciously doesn't understand why everybody doesn't have a problem with flying.
So how do you take, because the way you lay it out, it just sounds so logical and so sort of matter of fact, but anybody who's been on a crazy bumpy flight in a thunderstorm with a landing that just terrifies you knows that life just isn't always that linear. So how do you take the things you've just talked about, you know, so nice and neat and tidy, and put them onto that plane in that thunderstorm?
Well, you first got to be sure that what you're doing actually is okay. You got to be sure that it's not a foolhardy thing to do. statistics don't seem to help people, but if you can think about how control is valuable to us, if an anxious flyer can understand how flying is so controlled, that does give them some help. And so I go about it by giving people a pilot's point of view of how flying works. If this particular problem develops, this is the first step the pilots choose to do to remedy it. If that doesn't work, they go to the next. And then if that doesn't work, they go to a very simple solution to turn on some systems that are very basic to deal with the problem. So when you realize we've got that kind of thing set up for everything that could go wrong, then people feel pretty comfortable about flying, at least intellectually. So once again, that doesn't change how they feel emotionally. Emotionally, as you can see, it's a different ballgame. I've got to be in control or able to escape to feel comfortable. Once the stress hormones are released, so what we do is we say, okay, now that you're satisfied that flying is okay, what can we do to just turn off the release of stress hormones? It's like in your kitchen with a smoke alarm. If the toaster is burning toast, you could, if you wanted to do so, take the battery out to get rid of the noise. Well, we can do that with the amygdala. There is a hormone called oxytocin that when it's produced, it turns the amygdala off. So we look for a situation that produces oxytocin. We say, okay, go back and remember that vividly. I'll give you an example. When a mother is nursing a child, she produces oxytocin in large amounts so that she feels mellow and doesn't feel anxious like, oh, somebody's going to come over. They're going to say I'm a lousy housekeeper. No, she doesn't care. She just takes care of what the baby needs. She can do that because oxytocin is calming her by shutting down the amygdala. So we look for a moment that produces oxytocin, then we just, like Pavlov's dogs, we want to link that event that produces oxytocin to the door of the plane closing, the plane taking off, cruising along, even if it's in turbulence, landing, and so on. And that takes care of the stress hormone release.
So we picture a situation where we feel comfortable or someone who comforts us and consciously focus on that on each step of the plane flight, and that might trigger oxytocin and calm down that amygdala?
Well, you've kind of covered two systems there. There is a system that if we're with someone that we're very calm with, that system works not hormonally but neurologically to slow the heart rate and activate what's called the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the gut-level calming. So the other is a moment that produces oxytocin that prevents the release of stress hormones. Mm-hmm. Now, what I tell people to do is don't wait till you get on the airplane and try to do this. The amygdala reacts very fast. We want to do this in preparation. We want to do this before the flight. Go through the things that are going to happen on the flight. You know what they are. The door closes, the plane taxis out, and so on. You want to imagine that you have some photographs and use black and white so that it's not too likely to trigger stress hormones. Black and white snapshot. And put it by the face of the person who's very attuned to you, person you feel both physically and psychologically safe with in that moment. So that links it up to the what you suggested, the calming person that you're with. But a mother who's nursing a child can, or who has done that, they can link to a moment where they recall nursing the child and pretend that they're holding, or someone's holding a picture by the baby's face. So that then links the baby nursing to oxytocin, and the other is the system where you link the friend's face to the slowing of the heart rate.
Is there a difference if you're traveling alone or if you're traveling with somebody, you know, a spouse or a family member? Do any of your methods change, or is it pretty much the same thing regardless?
Well, what I want to do is have people build in what they need, because if you are with someone, it does help you feel better, but depending on somebody with you tends to be a day late and a dollar short. When you're still going to get the stress hormones. You're going to feel better because you're with someone. What you can do, though, if you set this exercise up before you fly and link it up so it works automatically, you can nip it in the bud. You can prevent the release of stress hormones or instantly override it. You don't even have any feeling that you're stressed at all.
Also, for pre-flight anxiety, I understand you have a trick you call the 5-4-3-2-1. What is that?
Yes. Well, it's just a game to play with yourself to keep your mind occupied, to keep from letting the anxious thoughts take hold. Once you do have an anxious thought, it produces the stress hormones, and then that keeps you focused on the anxiety-producing situation. So you play this game with yourself. What it amounts to is, first of all, focus on something straight ahead that tends to keep the mind focused. So find some object to focus on. Like I have my computer here. Okay, so I'm going to look at the Apple logo. And in my peripheral vision, I can see some other things. I'm going to make five statements. Five statements starting with the words, I see. So there's a little hypnotic kind of repetitious thing there. So I see a copier. I see a photograph. I see a screwdriver. I see my cell phone. I see my glasses. Okay, five things I see. Okay, now we're going to switch to things I hear. Well, I hear the sound of my own voice, so it's very quiet here. I can hear a car outside. I can hear the refrigerator. Oh, no more new additional things I'll go back to. I hear the sound of my own voice, and I hear the car outside. Okay, so it's okay to repeat things, whatever's coming to mind. Then, so we've gone from what you see to what you hear. Now we go to what you feel. I feel the phone at my ear. I feel my elbow on the chair. I feel my foot on the floor. I feel the label of the shirt on my back, and I feel some kind of itchiness back there also. It must be an insect bite. I don't know. Anyway, five things you see, five things you hear, five things you physically touch. Not the things you feel like I'm upset, but physical, basic things that you physically perceive. Okay, if you kept doing this for about 2 minutes without with intense concentration, the stress hormones will be used up, and then you'll be relaxed again. But to make sure that you keep the exercise challenging, you don't keep doing five. The second time around, seeing, hearing, touch, you do four. Then the next time you do three, then two, and then one. This exercise was actually developed as an insomnia cure, because if you do this when you're trying to fall asleep, you basically push the anxiety-producing thoughts to keep you from going to sleep aside. But it works also for flying.
We'll leave it there for now. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Captain Tom Bunn, president of SOAR, a company that helps clients overcome their fear of flying, author of SOAR, The Breakthrough Treatment for Fear of Flying.